5. An abstract confession. Do you suppose she's an actress? Poirot's conversation with the sculpture had begun with this bold question from her. He understood her to be talking about Joan Blythe. She continued, "Could anyone really be as witless as she seems? I think that was a performance from start to finish." "You do not believe her fear and unhappiness are real?" "No, she was playing a part. As for why this particular part, that is puzzling. I can't think that he would have asked her to, but perhaps he did." "He?" Poirot inquired. "Mr. Bixby. I think several people on this coach are actors and not real customers of his business."
"Might I ask why you say so, mademoiselle?"
"How many times has he so far drawn to your attention the fact that every seat is taken, that one cannot leave it to chance if one wants to travel with the Kingfisher Coach Company, that one must book a place well in advance of the desired date of travel?" "Well?"
"Many times," Poirot admitted.
"It's all we have heard from him since we arrived at the meeting point in London, and he sounds very much as if he's reciting well-rehearsed lines. Think about this, Monsieur Poirot. Why would he bother to tell us at all if it were true? We would have seen with our own eyes that the coach was full, yet he mentions it over and over again. When a fact is both evident and true, and when nobody is attempting to deny its truth, one does not feel the need to insist upon it so relentlessly. Think what obnoxious company he is, how he inflicts himself on his customers, who cannot possibly want to listen to his endless, tedious speeches. Does he strike you as a man who would do well in business? Of course not. Which means that he must have paid at least half of us passengers to pretend to be paying customers in order to make his firm seem far more successful than it is."
"I see no evidence for this," Poirot told her, "though it is an interesting possibility.
When I say actors, I don't mean that they've played King Lear at the Fortune Theatre or anything like that," the sculptor said impatiently. "I'm talking about a few shillings stuffed into the pockets of Mr. Bixby's acquaintances. It's hardly the most demanding role, is it? Sit on a coach and allow those around you to assume you paid for your ticket as they paid for theirs."
"If you are correct, why have we heard none of our fellow passengers volubly proclaiming the wonders of Kingfisher coaches and announcing their intention never to travel with any other companies?"
"It's hard to hear much of anything above the noise of the wretched engine," said the sculptor. "It is perfectly possible that Mr. Bixby would not have thought to make that additional request of them. You credit him with too much imagination."
"I might say the same to you, mademoiselle. The arranging of the passengers who are not really passengers, this is a scheme that would take more imaginative flair than our Monsieur Bixby possesses."
"Again we disagree," she said coolly. "Desperation breeds imagination, even in the minds of the dull-witted."
"May I ask you a question, mademoiselle? Have I done something to offend you?"
She laughed. "It is I who have offended you, Monsieur Poirot, whether you realize it or not. You scour my every remark in search of the sycophantic adoration you have come to expect, and find none of it. This mystifies you. You are so accustomed to receiving fawning praise that anyone who speaks to you as if they are your equal is interpreted as hostile."
"You would not define your attitude towards me as hostility?"
Poirot inquired in an even tone. The sculptor turned in her seat so that she could look more squarely at him. She seemed to him to be weighing up whether or not to say something.
"Your life's work, the mission that you have set for yourself, this vocation that I'm sure you see as noble and sacred, is to bring murderers to justice. Would you agree?"
Poirot considered it. Finally, he said, "I have never thought of myself as having a mission. There are things I believe to be sacred. The right of all men, women, and children to live the lives that have been given to them, and not to have those lives ended too soon by violence. The importance of restraining the disorderly elements in a society so that the world is safe for those who wish only to live in peace and according to the law." He nodded, satisfied with his answer. "That is the purpose of Hercule Poirot. The bringing of murderers to justice is a necessary part of it, I grant you, but all that I do for the sake of what I cherish and wish to preserve.
It is a terrible tragedy to have as one's foremost purpose in life a preoccupation with that which one detests. Poirot had noticed that, as he was speaking, the sculpture was growing increasingly agitated. When he stopped, her relief was visible. She said abruptly, "You are revered all over the world for your achievements, but I find your presumption rather naive, this belief that you can keep everybody safe from harm, that murders should be prevented and murderers dispatched to the gallows." She waved her hand dismissively. "Murder is not the only or even the greatest harm one person can do to another, and besides, it cannot be stopped." Poirot regarded her gravely. "Now I begin to wonder if you are the actress, mademoiselle. Do you seriously suggest that we should allow murderers to commit their crimes without interference?" "It is not a question of allowing," she said, reminding Poirot of a schoolmistress giving much-needed instruction to her least favourite pupil. "They will do it anyway, as they always have. What is your solution? That we kill all the murderers? If that is your answer, then you do believe that sometimes the taking of a life is justified. Many murderers would agree with you. I suppose you are travelling to the Kingfisher Hill estate." "No, only to Cobham," Poirot added an embellishment. "There my friend Catchpole and I will be met by a very dear old friend of mine, whom I first met as a young policier." He stopped and smiled. "But you do not want to know about my dear friend. Why do you ask if I am going to Kingfisher Hill?" "Are you?" "No," she snapped, as if horrified by the idea. "I'm getting off at Martyr's Green. I thought perhaps you might have a country residence at Kingfisher Hill. It would suit you."
"I do not."
"All the puffed-up lords and ladies there would doubtless agree with you that the powerful should be able to put to death anyone who displeases them and call it by the name of justice."
"You assume the worst of me, mademoiselle."
Thoughtfully, Poirot looked at her.
"At the same time, yes, you endeavour to present yourself in your least favourable aspect. Why, I do not believe that you truly in your heart approve of murder."
"I am not impartial in this matter." She hesitated for a moment before saying, "Oh, caution be damned. I will say it, and there will be nothing you can do, since we are strangers to one another." Lowering her voice, she said, "I have committed a murder myself."
"Please, tell me it is not so," said Poirot.
He wished he could believe that he had misheard her over the angry rumble of the engine, but he knew precisely what she had said. And then she said it again.
"It is quite true,"
she mouthed the words at him.
"I killed a man."
Then, speaking once more at normal volume, she said, "Nobody could have stopped me. I did it deliberately and was quite set on doing it. Afterwards, I felt no regret. I'm glad I did it. There, now you know. What are you going to say to that?" She smiled at him coldly.
"Whom did you kill, and why?" he asked.
"If I told you that, you might be able to identify the case in question. I cannot risk it. I've only confided as much as I have in the hope that you might make an effort to see things in the round, from the murderer's point of view as well as the victim's."
"The murderer's point of view," Poirot repeated slowly.
It was hard to produce any words in response to her extraordinary proclamations.
"Yes."
The sullen veneer was gone, and she sounded suddenly jubilant. Leaning in towards Poirot, she whispered as if sharing a delicious secret.
"Once you have killed a person, it becomes infuriating to contemplate the likes of Hercule Poirot with their determination to eradicate and punish something that is an ever-present part of life and always will be. Something that, in certain circumstances, can feel natural and even beneficial. The wish to kill is simply a part of human nature."
Poirot was deeply unsettled.
"May God forgive you for these callous words," he muttered.
"Well, there's no need to resort to hysterics," said the sculpture. "And remember, God has far more than words to forgive me for. I can't help noticing that you assume he shares your principles. Of course you do. What if I were to tell you that he thoroughly approves of murder, and that is why it's as prevalent as it is throughout the world?"
Poirot thumped his knee with his closed fist. "You are teasing, Poirot. You must be. No one could say these things and believe them."
She seemed to take pity on him. "You are right,"
I am teasing you a little. I do not approve of murder in all or even most cases. There, is that better? I do wonder, though, do you and your sort really need to make quite such a fuss about it when it happens?
Ah, so you admit that you jest, said Poirot. Merci à Dieu.
Then you have committed no murder.
She frowned.
I did not say that. I have committed one murder. It was my only choice in the situation. I do not approve of killing people all over the place, any more than you do, but in this instance it was necessary, and I... Yes, I will say it. I am glad I did it.
Poirot was starting to feel a sickness in the pit of his stomach. It was clear that she was playing a game of sorts, but he feared that, on the essential point, she spoke the truth.
I can tell you a little of the story if you would like to hear it, she offered. I think I can render it in the abstract, so that there is no chance of you finding me after today. I should actually enjoy hearing the thoughts of an expert on murder. It is something I've never been able to discuss with anybody, and, well, you are not just anybody, Monsieur Poirot. What do you say? Shall I tell you all about it?
Poirot shuddered, which seemed to thrill her.
Oh, do say yes. I feel that you and I might have the most fruitful discussion on a topic that is of great import to us both. Such exchanges are rare.
Now her manner was that of an overexcited child, though Poirot expected that the cold, gloating superiority might return at any moment. Feeling complicit in something monstrous, yet telling himself, as comfort, that it might all be lies, or that she might unintentionally let slip information that he could later use in the service of justice, Poirot said,
Very well. Tell me your story. Let me ask first one question. In your bag you have a book, n'est-ce pas? A book by the name of Midnight Gathering.
Ah, has your prying inspector friend filed a report on me? Why do you ask about the book?
You are fond of crime, mademoiselle. Did you steal it?
Did I steal Midnight Gathering? What an extraordinary question. No, I did not.
And if I do not believe you?
She searched his face carefully, then gave an uncertain laugh.
If you must know, the copy in my bag was originally a gift from... Well, I shall tell you no more, as it's none of your concern. If you are not careful, I will change my mind about telling you anything at all. You have one last chance, Monsieur Poirot. I can't think why you should wish to distract me with talk of books when I'm eager to tell you about...
She lowered her voice.
The man I killed. Shall I give up on you now as a hopeless scatterbrain, or may we speak of murder now?
With little appetite for what he imagined he was about to hear, Poirot invited her to tell her story. The sculptor took a few moments to prepare herself. Then, as soon as she began to speak, her face lost its hard contours and her eyes filled with tears. For the first time since making her acquaintance, Poirot was able to see her as someone capable of feeling pain, not only of inflicting it on others.
There was a man, she said. I loved him very much, more than I have ever loved anyone, before or since. And I murdered him.
She pulled a handkerchief out of her bag and dabbed at the corners of her eyes.
Those are the bare bones of it. There is more, of course. But never forget, when you hear the rest of the story, that my love for him was as strong when I killed him as it had always been. It was in no way diminished.
This is not as unusual as you may think, Poirot told her. Some murderers hate their victims, but those who kill loved ones are as numerous and suffer all the more.
Yes, I can see that.
Did he betray you?
Yes. At least I think he did. He would have denied it, and you would probably have taken his side. I think most people would. In any case, his betrayal of me was not the reason I killed him. I did it for the sake of my family. You see, he'd committed a crime. He stole from my father a lot of money. Afterwards, my father insisted that I was to have nothing to do with him. He was evil, an enemy, no longer allowed to come to our house. My parents were not willing to see him or speak to him. They refused to listen to his side of the story. And do not tell me, Monsieur Poirot, that a thief cannot have a defense that is worth attending to.
I had not thought to do so. However, your father's anger is understandable, is it not? I take it he trusted this young man? He would have trusted him with his life before the theft of the money, yes. The thing is, the man would never have stolen from anybody if the predicament had not been dire. His theft was not for his own benefit. He worked for my father, you see, and my father rewarded him generously. But while he was doing well financially, he had a friend whose family had lost everything when the stock market fell apart 2 years ago. Everything. And his father was very sick and very old and, well, our thief, if we can call him that, could not bear to see his friend consumed by the fear of ending up in a workhouse. And being in charge of my father's investments and business affairs, he thought, well, he knew that my father would not miss a certain amount. There would be no hardship for our family, none at all, if he were to take this money and give it to his friend. So that was what he did. But he didn't see it as giving the money, or even theft, really. He saw it as a loan. And that was certainly the spirit in which his friend accepted it. It was offered not as charity, but in the form of a challenge.
What challenge? Asked Poirot.
The thief and his friend were great believers in enterprise. In that respect, they and my father were all cut from the same cloth. They all believed, that anyone can start with not very much at all and go on to build empires and create riches beyond the wildest dreams of most. The agreement was that the friend would borrow the money and use it shrewdly to produce more money.
Or with the stock market as it was 2 years ago, as it remains to this day, this is not so easy, Poirot observed.
No, it is not, the sculptor agreed. But the man I loved had always had this belief that, well, that absolutely anything was possible, and that if you wanted something enough, you could always find a way to get it. He made other people believe it too. She looked down at her hands. I wish you could meet him, Monsieur Poirot.
You say this now, yet only minutes ago you said you were glad to have killed him.
I mean that I wish you could have met him before, while we were all still happy.
I see. Please continue with your story, said Poirot.
She dabbed at her eyes a few times, then said, Together, the thief and his friend made several extremely risky investments. Most of them failed, as risky investments tend to, but one succeeded beyond anything they had hoped for. And it was enough to enable the thief to put back quite a bit more than he had stolen from my family, and for his friend to ensure a life of comfort for himself and his elderly father. There was plenty left over, too, and the thief and his friend used it to set up some excellent schools in which pupils are treated with respect as if they are proper people who matter. That ought to happen in ordinary schools, but rarely does. And then she choked on the words. Poirot noted that it was not easy for her to tell this story and wondered why she was putting herself through the ordeal.
Then the thief made a terrible mistake. He told my father, told both of my parents what he had done.
Ah, he preferred the honesty to the concealment.
He was an honorable man, Monsieur Poirot. He valued integrity above all else and had always planned to tell the truth as soon as the money was returned. He knew how my father admired him and could not allow that admiration to continue based on a false premise. Of course, he anticipated that my father would be angry at first, but he believed that if he apologized and described the precise circumstances...
She was speaking quickly now and breathlessly, as if trapped in a nightmare she was desperate to escape, appearing to have forgotten that these were past events.
He thought that if he made it clear that he would not have rested easy until every single penny taken had been returned... But my father is an unforgiving man, and my mother agrees with my father about everything. She cannot even bring herself to say that a book or play that he likes is not to her taste, for fear of one of his tyrannical outbursts. And so the thief was...
She stopped and covered her mouth with her handkerchief.
Sent away. He was banished.
Did your parents know that you loved this man?
Oh, yes. But it made no difference to them. My father told me that if I had any more contact with him, ever, I would be cut off without so much as a farthing to my name. I believed at the time that I had no choice but to obey.
May I ask, before these events occurred, were you betrothed to this thief? No? She looked amused. What makes you ask that? I just wondered. I noticed that you wear the ruby ring now. Oh, that, yes, well, I am now engaged to be married. To somebody else. The sculpture made an impatient noise. I like to think that I am a person of the highest determination and ingenuity, but even I could not succeed in marrying a dead man. The man you intend to marry, do you love him? Her expression grew solemn and studious, as if she was concentrating on something important. Yes, I do. If you're about to ask me if I love my fiancé as much as I loved the thief, though goodness knows why you're interested in that when it is hardly the point of my story, the answer is no, I do not. I hope this doesn't disturb you, Monsieur Poirot. It does not pose a problem for me. My love for the thief could not have been more different in character, and the thief is dead. This last emphasized word provoked more tears. I tried as hard as I could to persuade Daddy to forgive him, but it proved impossible. Have you ever tried to persuade a stubborn man that he is wrong, and at the same time to convince him that you do not disagree with him at all? Is that not a contradiction? Asked Poirot. Nobody could do both at once. Oh, yes, they could. I did. I said, come now, Daddy, you are so wise and fair, everybody knows this, and the wise and fair thing to do here is exactly as you have done so far, because it would have been a mistake to be too lenient when you first heard of the offence, but now the next correct thing to do is to give him another chance, as I'm sure you'll be the first to see. I'm sure, in fact, that you have had this brilliant idea yourself, and do not need me to suggest it to you. I thought if I poured on the flattery... She sighed. That strategy sometimes works with Daddy. But this time it did not. No, it only made him angrier. He made ever more extravagant threats against me. I would be penniless, without a home, without kin. If I betrayed our family by siding with a thief, he would revenge himself upon me in terrible ways that I could not imagine. You are afraid of him. I am afraid of him. I still do not see the shape of the picture, said Poirot. You loved the thief, and you do not love your father. I wonder if, by your own assessment, you have perhaps murdered the wrong person. Oh, I love Daddy, said the sculptor. I fear him, dislike him, and cannot bear to be in his company. But I think I also love him in a way. Mother, too. Though she sat demurely by his side and uttered not one word of protest when he made those vile threats to me. Even so, said Poirot, what you have told me is not the story of a daughter who murdered her father. Anyone would expect him to be your chosen victim, no? Not the thief whom you so loved and admired. What, I beg to know, can have led you to kill him? What indeed? She said, as if the two of them were trying to solve the puzzle together. All of the events I have described took place between November of 1929 and March of last year, when the thief was cut off by my parents. Idiotically, I believe that I had no choice but to cut him off too. I was not asked for my opinions. They were given to me by my father, forced upon me. The thief was the human embodiment of evil and must under no circumstances be allowed back into our lives. I must stop loving him. My father said those words to me. You do not love him any more. You see him for the enemy he is. He is dangerous. He is wicked. He is a threat to this family. I had to endure hours of it. Daddy would not leave me alone until he was confident that he had removed all my thoughts and feelings and replaced them with his own. And then 5 months later, in August of last year, my mother was told that she was dying. I am sorry, mademoiselle. She is still alive now, but she won't be for very long, said the sculptor. She has an illness that is causing her to waste away before our eyes. In a falsely bright and jocular tone, the sculptor went on,
Anyway, you will never guess what happened 2 weeks after she received her diagnosis, Monsieur Poirot. It was such a delightful surprise. My father summoned me to the room he infuriatingly calls... She stopped. Whatever her father called the room, she had decided against sharing it. To his study, she said instead. He told me that now Mother had only limited time left, the thief was to be readmitted to the fold. I see. Poirot had not expected the story to take this turn. A delightful surprise, she repeated, her voice throbbing with anger. I'm afraid I cannot tell you why my mother's impending death made it so urgent for us all to forgive the thief and invite him back into our lives, not without revealing certain particulars that I would prefer not to discuss. All that matters is that Mother and Daddy were suddenly ready to welcome him back, and I was told that I must do the same. And so back he came, and once again he was put in charge of managing my father's business affairs. Not only was I ordered to forgive him, that would have been bad enough, but I was also told that I would be cut off and reviled forever if I did not participate in the pretense that nothing had ever happened. Incroyable, Poirot breathed. Quite, said the sculpture. I'm so glad you agree. Please go on, mademoiselle. There's not much more to say. The thief was happy to return and happy to collude in the pretense that nothing unfortunate had ever occurred. He came back at the end of August, and a little over 3 months later, I killed him. There, that's the whole story, the end. Why did you kill him? When the motive is unknown, the story is always incomplete. It is missing its most vital part. The sculptor laughed. Pardon me, but have I been under a misapprehension all this time? Are you not Hercule Poirot? Surely I do not need to tell you why I did it. You are the great detective, are you not? I would hate to deprive you of the opportunity to work it out for yourself. I have told you everything that you need to know. Why do you think I killed this man I loved so much? You said before that you did it for the sake of your family, and I tell you again that this makes no sense to me. To kill a man you love so much for the sake of... who? Your parents? You claim to love them also. But did you not love the thief more? Oh, yes, much more. Then why kill him? And why for your family's sake? Explain it to me. No, said the sculptor. Making sense of things like this is what you're supposed to be good at. And what if it's not true that I did it for the sake of my parents? You told me that was your reason. Then you should ask yourself, why would I say that if it wasn't true? Mademoiselle, you confuse me greatly. That is certainly not my intention, she said solemnly. Her eyes once again were full of tears. I shall be quiet and say no more. Poirot wondered if he had ever before had such a discomforting exchange with another human being. He tried every tactic he could think of to persuade her to explain herself, but her resolve did not weaken, and he arrived at Cobham with his bewilderment fully intact.